We turn back to where we were at the end of last session on the last page of the resource note on God's creativity, God as creator. There is a little bit of further discussing to be done in relation to the problems concerning creation that are mentioned in paragraph 5. This is an area where a tremendous amount of anxious debate goes on, and it's been like that for more than 100 years. I am not sure that it's an area of prime importance in the sense that it's vital to know what conclusion to come to in these debates. But I am sure that it's an area of uncertainty for a lot of the Lord's people. Therefore, I'm not going simply to pass it by. So look at the problems concerning creation and the relation between biblical witness and scientific inquiry. That's really what these problems are about. It is alleged that there's a clash between what science teaches about the cosmos and what Scripture teaches about the cosmos. And my remarks now, brief as they'll be, are intended to ensure that we none of us get derailed in that particular discussion. The first problem listed here, 5a, is the problem of relating biblical and scientific accounts of the nature of the cosmos to each other. After the word nature, there might, with advantage, be an insert, which I didn't put in when I composed this. Nature and origin, I might have written. Because although origins are the special concern of 5b, you can't discuss the nature of the cosmos without at least hinting at what you think about its origin, and something about that has to be said under 5a in order to deal with the problem as it's posed. The simple guideline for working through this is to say, remember the limits of scientific inquiry, theorizing, and outlook. Scientists, natural scientists as we call them, study the cosmos as a going concern. They study it from the inside as it goes all around them. They study the processes which surround them, the processes which are actually taking place as they watch, either with the naked eye or through the telescope or through the microscope or however they make their observations. If that is what they are doing, you wouldn't expect that any form of scientific inquiry would be able to tell you anything definitive about origins. How could it? The very method of studying the going concern from within really rules out the possibility that science will ever be able to tell us where the cosmos came from, or how it began, in the sense of starting to be, when previously there was nothing there. The Bible, on the other hand, is God-centered from Genesis to Revelation and views the cosmos always as the product of God's creative work. Its starting point is Revelation, which is not the case with natural science. And by Revelation, the Bible writers are able to tell us things which, in principle, science couldn't discover. Science studies how it all works. The Bible tells us who brought it into being, who set it going, who overrules all those processes that the scientists study. These are questions which demand revelation before they can be answered. They are questions, as I said, on which the method of the natural sciences rules out in advance any definite discovery. This point is not pressed against Christians as hard now as it was by spokesmen, professed spokesmen, self-appointed spokesmen for the natural sciences 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago. The ideology, for that's what it was, which looked to science to answer all questions about reality and which devalued all other ways of finding out about reality apart from the empirical scientific method of going and looking at it, that attitude rode very high and was affirmed against Christians very strongly until quite recent times. But you know, I'm sure, that one of the marks of the postmodern era, is which everybody says we're now in, is that though it appreciates the technology which science has given us, it has no confidence in natural science to answer ultimate questions. Just at that point, it's come round to seeing what Christians have been saying for the century and a half in which protagonists and spokesmen for science have been saying the opposite. That being so, it's more, it's more straightforward and more respectable for Christian theists to say, well, we are now appreciating the limits of science. There are questions science can't answer. We offer what we believe to be a reasonable view based on what we believe to be divine revelation. Consider it. Just consider it. And that's how the two avenues of inquiry, the scientific and the biblical, must finally relate. The biblical revelation provides a framework within which all the scientific knowledge about how the cosmos works, what processes are going on within it, and so on, all that the scientists have learned by going and looking, in other words, must be set within this framework, or within this frame, shall I say. But the frame is the understanding that God made everything, the big things, the small things, the animated things, the inanimate things. The whole cosmos is his handiwork, and furthermore, it's through his continued output of sustaining power that the cosmos continues to exist and function. Should he cease at any moment to exercise that power, well, we'd be back to where we were before the universe was made. That is, there would be literally nothing except God himself. The scientists in the days when their omnicompetence seemed to them so obvious had at best a deistic, mechanistic view of the cosmos, which the historians of science trace back to people like Newton with his laws. The deistic idea was, and among deists still is, that God made the cosmos with a principle of stability within itself, then he took his hands off it and didn't involve himself in its ongoing functions. Meantime, the natural laws, the immanent laws of operation and energy, which he built into the cosmos, ran, or operated, shall I say, and so the cosmos ran in the way that a clock runs or goes when you've wound it up. The spring, if it's a clock that works on a spring, or the weights, if it's a long case clock, or carriage clock, or whatever, there's part of the mechanism which provides the energy with which the clock goes. We are used, of course, to winding our clocks. These scientists said, well, there is reason to think that at the beginning of things, whenever that was, if indeed there was a beginning, a certain amount of energy was built into the cosmos, and the second law of thermodynamics tells you that it's slowly leaching out so that eventually perhaps everything will run down. But we don't know too much about that. We concede that that's what seems to be happening, but, well, when you get right down to it, we don't know anything and we can't know anything about the beginning of things and the end of things, so let's not bother about it. Let us continue to study the cosmos on the supposition that it's always been here and always will be here. That's cartoon language, of course, but that was what the position taken by so many spokesmen for science amounted to. However, confidence in the omnicompetence of science to tell us things, and confidence that nobody else except the scientists are able to tell us anything, that has dissolved away. I think that future historians will describe it as a neurosis of the West. It never made any impact, as far as I'm aware, on Asia, nor on Africa, and why should it? To be perfectly honest, it was provincial and it was nutty. But it was the characteristic view of the Western culture from the time when the Enlightenment got into its stride, which is late 17th and then 18th century, up to the present day. But the deistic idea is, as I've said already in this course, is the wrong notion to have of the cosmos anyway. Scripture says that the second person of the Godhead, who was the Father's agent in bringing it into being, upholds it by the word of his power, and that it hangs together, holds together in him. Take him away, take his activity away, and nothing would exist, nothing apart from God himself would exist anymore. Within that frame of reference, I don't think you'll have much difficulty in relating biblical and scientific accounts of the nature of the cosmos to each other, because your theology is going to explain, first of all, the nature of the cosmos. It's upheld by God, the deistic idea that things have their own principle of stability and continuance in themselves is false. And so the regularities of what they call natural law, as we said yesterday, are just as much works of God as the irregularities of the transcend natural law, of which we were thinking yesterday, which we call miracles, signs and wonders. And that's all I propose to say about 5a. Before you start asking questions, let me go on to 5b and say a word about how we relate biblical and scientific accounts of the origin of the cosmos to each other, and what in particular do we say about evolution. The preferred account of the beginning of things among cosmologists today is the Big Bang. Well, we all of us know that. I'm no scientist, and I couldn't give you all the technical small print, but I don't think there's any doubt, because the top scientists don't have, cosmologists don't have any doubt that there was a Big Bang. That, however, doesn't tell you, I think I said this yesterday, what it was that went bang, what was there to go bang, if I may put it that way. And so the scientific accounts still, as I said a moment ago, stop short as a study of the cosmos in its character as a going concern, and isn't able to tell us what lies behind, or what preceded or brought about the cosmos as a going concern. Scripture again tells us that God called the cosmos into being. If the Big Bang hypothesis is correct, and we assume it at the present time, scientists of course may change their mind, but it's not for us theologians to change their mind for them. They have worked out Big Bang theory in terms of a great deal of math and a great deal of technical resourcefulness for dating things, and we'll accept what they tell us seems certain, so we will. But they can't tell us, as I say, what was there to go bang, and at this point one still has to go back to Genesis chapter 1 and all the other statements all the way through the Bible which celebrate creation as God's work. But what about evolution, people ask? Isn't it almost certain, if not quite certain, a lot of scientists say it's quite certain, that our human bodies came from simpler forms of physical life? And isn't it warrantable, in terms of that insight, to suppose that the whole of human history of human cultures, civilizations, right up to the present time, is a story of how mankind progressed from simple forms of life to elaborate and sophisticated ones, which are better in every way than those that preceded, have more value built into them? In other words, doesn't the hypothesis of evolution warrant an idea of perpetual progress, in every sense of that word, progress in the human community? To which the appropriate Christian answer, I think, takes the following form. One, the theory of evolution is only a theory about the development of the complex reality of the human body. It doesn't tell you a thing about the mind or the mental life of any of the items in the evolutionary family tree. If the theory were true, there would still be need to posit some special event, which the Christian will call a special act of God, whereby the first man, first human, came to self-consciousness and God-consciousness, those two realities together, or putting it the other way around, whereby the first man became conscious of himself as a responsible moral person in the presence of God. That isn't an awareness that evolved, that could have evolved, as far as we can see. There's nothing in the evolutionary hypothesis and the evidence for it to tell us how such a sense of reality could have evolved. No, we still have to posit an act of God at this point if we're going to be reasonable people in terms of the evolutionary hypothesis, let alone faithful people in terms of what the Bible says. You should know that ever since the last third of the last century, Roman Catholic scholars have almost unanimously embraced the theory of evolution, but posited a divine creative act at this point, whereby after the human body has evolved, God breathed into the first man the breath of life, and he became a living soul in the full personal sense of that phrase. And though that's only guesswork, I mean, it's a guess, or hypothesis, shall I say. Hypothesis is the scientific word for guess, isn't it? All right, let's call it a hypothesis. It's a hypothesis about how to square that statement in Genesis 2 and verse 6 with the evolutionary theory. Well, as I said, if the evolutionary theory has substance in it, it is reasonable to posit such a creative act of God turning, a better than monkey, a monkey-like physical organism into a human being. That's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is that in terms of all analogies, the evolutionary hypothesis, though you can make it seem very, very plausible by not raising certain questions, is a very strange hypothesis, and one which assumes that things went contrary to what to the way that other things go in the universe, really without exception. The evolutionary hypothesis tells you that random mutations at genetic level produced more and more in the way of order, more and more in the way of integrated complexity. We're thinking of the human body now. More and more in the way of elaborate functioning. And there isn't a single parallel instance in the cosmos where random changes of any kind have produced an effect like that. From the philosophy of science standpoint, the evolutionary hypothesis is a very strange hypothesis indeed. You've heard it said that if you had 20 monkeys and they hammered on typewriters for long enough, they would, between them, write the Bible and Shakespeare. Personally, I don't think that's true. I think they could hammer typewriters till kingdom come, and there's no earthly reason to suppose that by random hammering of the keys, they would write either the Bible or Shakespeare. It's been said by the advocates of evolution, give them long enough and they'll do it. But really, that's just as unplausible a guess as the thought that organisms had long enough, so many billions of years, and over that period, which was long enough, that the simple forms of life like the amoeba were able to evolve into physical organisms like yours and mine. And it seems to me that the proper response to that affirmation is to say, chum, it isn't a question of time. It's a question of whether order comes out of chaos. It's a question of whether random action, random events, random processes aren't going to produce disorder rather than order. Everywhere else within the cosmos, they do. What warrant is there for supposing anything different in the case of physical organisms? Now, you can say then, if, of course, like the Christian, like me, you believe in a God who, in his creative providence, was overruling what happened to organisms, well, that would be giving the evolutionary hypothesis a theistic cast, and then perhaps you could say, not as a scientist now, but as a believer, this was a unique process simply because God the Creator, was guiding it in a unique way. And there have been people who've been called theistic evolutionists who have affirmed that, quite a lot of them, as a matter of fact. The Creation Research Society has no time for them, but you will find that among professional scientists who make a Christian profession, this view is commoner than any other. However, it's only a hypothesis still. It's only a guess. And nobody is committed to the evolutionary guess because of gaps in the evolutionary family tree and because of the intrinsic oddity of the idea that you have this process going on over millions of years producing the human body. So as science, in terms of philosophy of science, it seems to me that our second comment must be, evolution is by no means proven, and as a guess, it is very strange and contrary to all analogies. The third thing, however, which I think one should say, is that the biblical narratives of creation, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, don't obviously say anything that bears one way or another on the question of whether the evolutionary hypothesis might be true or not. In a moment, we will look at what Genesis 1 in particular says, and I'll show you how I think it ought to be interpreted. But for the moment, let me just make the assertion, and then pause and ask you whether there are any questions you want to ask or comments you want to make. For all I know, some of you are professional scientists who ought to be commenting this from the standpoint of your own technical expertise, which I can't match. Is that so? Is there anyone who has technical comments to make or general comments to make? Yeah, sir. Well, thank you for that comment. It isn't a question, and I'm not going to repeat it, except to say that our commentator was underlining the fact that more and more scientists nowadays are uncertain about this hypothesis as compared with their fathers and their grandfathers. Well, let's move on. The real interest, I think, for a theologian, as distinct from an apologist and as distinct from a scientist, is in knowing how to understand the biblical testimony to creation, and I want to say just a little about that. So turn up Genesis chapter 1 and have it before your eyes as I say this brief bit. There are three views which historically have been taken with regard to Genesis chapter 1, starting at verse 1 and actually going through to chapter 2, verse 4, where the initial presentation of creation ends. View number one is the naive view that what's being described here is what you and I, in principle, could have observed over the course of a working week, were we able to travel back in time to the moment when it all began. The days of Genesis, on this view, are 24-hour days. Evening and morning are 24-hour periods, as they are, or at least they indicate 24-hour periods. And so it was a literal week's work on God's part to put the initial chaotic mass, which presumably he produced by fiat, although it doesn't actually say that, to put that chaotic mass into shape, the shape of this planet as we now know it. View two says, no, we can't maintain that in face of the testimony of geology and all that physics tells us about the cosmos, biology, ethnology, which tells us that is believed to tell us that the cosmos took a long period, billions and billions of years, to get into the present shape. What we have to say, these people continue, is that there's a match, an observable and striking match, between the work of the 6 days and the stages of the cosmic evolutionary process, as contemporary science envisages them. So what we do is to say that the days of Genesis are pointers to geological epochs, and the statement, God said, let there be, points each time to processes which took millions of years to happen. And this view is called concordism because, as one rather witty Roman Catholic scholar once wrote, it seeks to enhance Moses' credit by giving him a degree in science. And reading Genesis 1, you see, as if it were allegorical science. If you didn't know what the scientists know, you'd never guess it was science, but now that you do know what the scientists know, you see that the right way to read it is as allegorical science. Allegorical because the details appear to be saying something else, but as I said, the discoverers of science show that this is actually the right way to read the story. The Roman Catholic scholars who embraced evolution from the latter decades of the last century, nearly all of them took this line. They were concordists. The third way of reading Genesis 1 is the way that I think is almost unanimously embraced by Old Testament scholars today, whether they be Catholic or Protestant, whether they be liberal or conservative. The view is that this chapter, on the face of it, is a quasi-liturgical celebration of the fact of creation, rather than being science in disguise, and certainly not a kind of naive observational account of what we would have seen if we could have traveled back in time and hovered above the chaos and watched how things got sorted out during 144 hours of our time. The argument for taking the story this way is drawn from its literary form, its literary genre. On the face of it, it's a narrative of celebration in which the repetitions contribute to the effect. An evening and a morning were such and such a day. And then the repeated word, let God said, let there be, this, that, and the other. Also, when you look at the story, you find that there's a parallel between the first 3 days and the second set of 3 days. On the first day, God says, let there be light. On the fourth day, God says, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky. And that's the sun and the moon and the stars. On the second day, God says, let there be sky, an expanse, that is, between the waters below and the waters up in the clouds above. And on the fifth day, the second day, you see, in the second series of three, the sky is filled with life. It's bird life. God blesses the birds. And he also fills the waters below, the sea, with life, fish. And then you look at the third day. On the third day, the dry land is separated from the waters. The dry ground appears, and the land begins to produce vegetation. On the sixth day, the third day in the second series, the land produces livestock, and then God makes humans to have dominion over the whole setup, to be God's bailiffs or stewards, managing the planet on his behalf. They are, the man and the woman are made in God's image, other creatures aren't, and they are set in charge of everything. So there's a scheme, the second set parallel to the first. And then again, you've got the refrain at the end of each day's work. God saw what he'd made, and it was good. He saw that it was good. Well, that's very schematic. That's very formal. It doesn't read in the least like allegorical science. It does read very much like a hymn with a chorus. We have hymns with choruses. Some of the phrases are repeated over and over, like choruses are repeated in hymns that have them. It's a prose passage, of course, yes, but it seems fair from a literary standpoint to say it's a prose poem. And those who understand it this way say, now the reference to the 6 days is simply part of the picture, just as God's declaration that everything is good is part of the picture. The picture is of the fact of creation, pictured in the form of a week's work. Those who take this view are likely to say, well, one supposes that it all started with a single fiat on God's part, and the cosmos sprang into being, didn't evolve, wasn't created bit by bit, but was all there, and that was the first moment of its life. But the thrust of Genesis chapter 1 is not to teach us science, it is rather to teach us a proper attitude of praise to God for creation, and celebration and appreciation of the creation that he's made. But the central thought is not meet the creation. The central thought is meet the creator. It's as if the chapter is, or Moses in the in this chapter, I'm going to say Moses till better instructed. Moses in this chapter is saying, hey, you've moved around in Vancouver or wherever it is that you live. You've observed the sea and you've observed the sky and you've noted the fish and you've noted the birds. And you've noted the animals, and you've noted the plants, you've noted the trees, you've noted
You noted the different sorts of grass and the different kinds of flowers. You've observed that this universe is full of a wonderful array of big things and little things and medium-sized things with marvelous variety. And it gives the impression, as you live in it, of being an ordered universe in which there's steadiness and rhythm and recurring patterns. It all seems to shout order every day of its continued operation. Well now, meet the person who produced it, who upholds it, who is responsible for it. Realize that the God who made all these things is to be worshipped as having the wisdom, the resourcefulness, and the power to make them, and that straightaway gives you a glorious, transcendent concept of who God is and sets you on the path of praise straightaway. The presentation of it in the form of a week's work is part of the part of the strategy of the Bible, because soon we are going to meet the fourth commandment in the Decalogue. Remember that you keep holy the Sabbath day, each seventh day following 6 days of work. You do that as a memorial of creation. For the picture of creation with which the Bible begins envisages God resting on the seventh day after the 6 days in which he put the cosmos in order. You are to be, you are to live that way and rest each seventh day after 6 days of work. This view of how to read Genesis chapter 1 used to be called the framework hypothesis. Different people have different names for it. Nowadays it's most commonly called the literary hypothesis. If you want to see it set out with ample learning in a way that I, for one, find quite irresistibly convincing, by all means, go to the book by Henri Blocher that is mentioned as item number 7 in the resource reading list. Blocher is, as conservative a Calvinist as myself. He teaches in a free faculty of theology in France. He's an extremely learned man, and he has written this book in the beginning, which, to my mind, expounds this hypothesis, this way of reading Genesis 1, in a way that's totally convincing. At every turn of the argument, he's saying, in effect, can't you see that the passage is asking to be read this way? As a picture of a week's work celebrating the fact of creation. Certainly, if you follow through on the way in which creation of the world is spoken of everywhere else in the Bible, you find that it's the fact of creation, followed by the fact of providential upholding, that is being spoken of. There doesn't seem to be in the Bible the slightest interest in giving what we would call a scientific account of stages or phases or processes by which it was done, but simply the fact is presented and proclaimed and rejoiced in. Equally certainly, if you try to make sense of concordism, you very soon find that you're up against trouble, because the sun and the moon and the stars, on your view, are not created until the fourth day. And yet there was light on the first day. What are you going to do with that? It makes just that one detail makes the concordist hypothesis seem very unnatural and artificial. The older exponents of the concordist theory tried to meet the point by saying, what the cosmologists say is that the Earth was originally a mass of gaseous matter which hadn't solidified out, and we are to imagine ourselves as imaginary observers in a spaceship or something up in the gaseous matter. And the light that came through on the first day was light from the sun, which was always there, but could hardly get through the thick, gaseous, cloudy matter. And then on the fourth day, what it really means is that the clouds cleared and the sun and the moon and the stars could be seen from our spaceship hovering now over the waters and the Earth, could be seen from our spaceship for the first time. It seems to me that in saying that, the concordists were wriggling. They were trying to escape the pressure of a very natural, simple fact about the presentation here, and their attempted explanation fails, because what it actually says in verse 14 is, God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky, and it was so. Verse 16, God made two great lights. It doesn't say he divided the clouds so that the two great lights made on day one, as we suppose, could shine through. It says God made two great lights,
the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night, and he made the stars, and verse 17, God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern day and night and to separate light from darkness. If this is part of the picture, and if we're simply meant to understand all this as part of that picture, which is conveying the message, remember that everything in the cosmos, from the biggest things, from the sun, the moon, and the stars, down to the fish and the birds and the flowers, were all of them made by the one marvelously wise and powerful being, whose name is Yahweh, Elohim, God, in other words. Well, there's no problem. But if you think that this is primitive allegorical science, well, you do have a problem. But why wish on yourself, I ask, that hypothesis? This, then, is the way, far and away the best way, in my judgment, to interpret Genesis 1:1 through Genesis 2:4. Are you hearing me? As I say, for the scholarly small print and the detailed exegesis, go to Blocher. He's done it extremely well. In telling you that I embrace this line of exposition, I'm not trying to force your pure minds into a place where they may not wish to go. If you find yourself more attracted to one of the other views, well, I just wish you luck in defending it. I couldn't defend either of the others, but you may be able to do that. I'm not declaring war on the creation research people, though, frankly, I do think that they're barking up the wrong tree. But what I'm trying to do as a theologian is to read my Bible in a way which receives the message that it's intended to give me. And that's the hypothesis, the guess, that I'm commending to you. I think that this is what Genesis 1 was written to bring to us. That is, this sense that now that we've begun to appreciate the marvels, the complexity, the wonder, the order, the beauties of creation, it's time we met the one who is responsible for it all, however he did it. Okay, you have a question, David.
Yes. It's hard to believe that there are two different stories.
Yeah. The question has to do with what are claimed to be the two creation stories of Genesis. Chapter 1, verse 1, down to chapter 2, verse 4, 4a, actually. And then chapter 2, 4b, down to the end of chapter 2, which is chapter 2, verse 25. I'm asked to comment on this. I see it as comparable to the way in which that film, which you've all of you seen, Christmas by Christmas, The Sound of Music, begins. And this was even clearer, I may say, when it first came out, because it belonged to the old pattern where frames of credits were produced first before any of the visuals began. When it's projected now, you will notice that it's done in the modern fashion. You start straight off with a scene, and the bits of credits that come at the beginning are projected onto the scene. But now forget the credits and just try to remember back as to how the film begins. And let's check, who's seen it? So, The Sound of Music, Julie Andrews. Okay, most of you have seen it, most of you will understand what I'm saying. For the first minute or so, perhaps it's 2 minutes, I'm not sure, what you have is a long view of the sky, blue sky with clouds scudding across it, and slowly the camera comes down and you begin to see the outlines of mountains, but it's a long view, distance view of everything. And then comes the moment when you're suddenly in a relatively close-up relation to a field in which Julie Andrews is dancing around singing a song. The world is alive with the sound of music. Are you with me? They fit together perfectly well. The first story sets the frame for the second. Well, that's how I think these two pieces of the narrative are meant to be related. The first narrative is saying, as I've been trying to project it, meet the God who made just everything there is. The second narrative is saying, now, understand what was involved when God created man and woman in his own image to rule his world, and understand what happened to them. The focus is much more of a close-up. You're in the Garden of Eden, watching the man and then the woman produced mysteriously from his side, and hearing the Lord tell them what they mustn't do, and then you go on to chapter 3, and you read of what they did. That's my proposed answer. I find no contradiction between the two stories. It's simply that the story of what happened really starts in narrative number 2, just as the story of The Sound of Music
really starts with that close-up of the meadow and Julie Andrews. Okay? At least try it on for size, friends. Any more questions before we finish with this? I've presented to you all I wanted to say about the problems relating to creation. As usual with me, it's taken a bit longer than I'd bargained for. But in a moment, we move on to the doctrine of providence. Just as soon as you're prepared to let me do that. But I don't want to stop anyone asking questions that they want to ask about this view, which for all I know will be news to you. I say, though the scholars are pretty much agreed on some form of the literary hypothesis, there are many churches and Christian circles into which this view hasn't yet trickled down. Yes, sir? Good question. I'm asked about the woman being created from man's side. Are we going to say that this is non-factual poetry or what? Here I tell you frankly that I don't know what one ought to say about the biology of it. I only know what it's right to say about the theology of it. I know about the theology because Christian expositors have been proclaiming the theology from the very beginning. There's a classic statement in Augustine, for instance, to the effect that the woman was made out of Adam's side so that he would recognize in her the completion of himself and would cherish her. She wasn't created in a way which encourages him to lord it over her, as if she were made to be his doormat. She wasn't, after all, created out of his foot. She was created out of his side for completion and companionship. I can't quote this exactly, but that's the sentiment, and Christian expositors have been saying that continually from Augustine's day to our own. And, well, the story goes on that way. This is when the woman is brought to the man says, this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. In other words, this is the completion of me. And you can see how that fits into the picture. A rib taken out of Adam's side and the woman formed out of the rib. Adam is now ribless. At least he's short of one rib. And the woman is given back to him and that completes him. Yes, it's a picture. I wouldn't call it a poem, but it's a prose picture, sure. It's a picture which matches, I think, some of the other details in Genesis 2 and 3. I take Genesis 2 and 3 to be historical, but I also take Genesis 2 and 3 to be told in a symbolic way. I would rather use the word symbolic than either mythical or fantasy or anything like that. It's rather that certain of the things that happened are described in a way which helps you to understand their meaning, as perhaps you wouldn't understand it if they weren't presented in this fashion. In other words, the details are presented symbolically so that the meaning will come across, the symbols, you see, being carriers of the meaning. I think, for instance, that whatever Eve may or may not have seen in the garden, the presentation of the tempter as a serpent in this story, where he's pictured as a real serpent who gets a serpent's curse, this is, I say, whether or not it's what we would have seen if we'd been there, it's a symbolic presentation of Satan, which is enormously enormously illuminating to the people of all cultures. Why? Well, because no culture in this world yet has ever produced people who were fond of snakes. Fond of snakes, I mean, in the sense of wanting to regard snakes as their friends. There have been a minority, I suppose, who've kept snakes as pets, and some have had bad experiences, actually, keeping snakes as pets. You should know that. Do any of you keep snakes as pets? Well, I don't think you're strange for not keeping snakes as pets. I think you're normal human beings, because in all cultures, the majority judgment has been, we don't like snakes. So to exhibit Satan, right from the word go, as a snake, snake in the grass, a snake with all the cunning and the subtlety and the dangerousness that we associate with snakes. We think of them as malevolent, and they slip in where they shouldn't, and they've got you often. On occasion, in cultures where there are snakes, they often have bitten people before people are aware that they're there, because, as I say, they move around so unobtrusively. All of this, it seems to me, is conveyed simply by exhibiting the tempter as a serpent. The serpent, in other words, is a very potent symbol for Satan. Well, this is the story of what happened right at the beginning. But Moses, as I think, is anxious that we get the right vibrations, the right feelings, the right emotional reaction to the story. And so symbolism is used. Satan appears as a serpent. Sure he does. And similarly, the picture of God making the woman out of Adam's rib, so that Adam recognizes in the woman that which completes him, and that the person without whom, I have to say, he wouldn't be complete. That, I think, is extremely illuminating. It teaches the basic truth about the two sexes as God made us. It establishes the right emotional frame for constructive relationships between men and women in the business of living. It's much more than the doctrine of marriage. It's the doctrine of the two sexes living and working together in the human community. And the sense on the part of both, actually, that persons of the other gender, persons of the other gender, do complete what I am and what I bring and what I've got to give, that I take to be a fundamental human perspective, which is something, in other words, which is felt throughout the human community, except in places where, for whatever reason, people have suppressed that sense of things and to that extent dehumanized themselves. There have been cultures in the past where women weren't appreciated as the completion of men. The ancient Greeks were like that. They married in order to have children, but the woman was treated as just a bit of apparatus around the house, and it was standard doctrine among the Greek philosophers that a man only finds fulfilling fellowship with other men. Well, that seems to me to be a rather sick and neurotic attitude among the ancient Greeks. And Genesis chapter 2 sets us on a different wavelength straight away. And as I said, I think that the human community generally has been on that wavelength. And you could, I think, properly say it's an element in general revelation that they should see the relation between the sexes that way. That the two sexes or two genders are complementary to each other. So I understand, I think, the theology and the thrust and the message of the story of how Eve came from Adam's rib, but as I said at the beginning, so now I say it again at the end, I don't understand the biology of it. I wasn't there. It's only been done once. I don't know really what God did. I'll just go on talking in terms of what Genesis 2 says and settle for God's way of presenting it. It seems to me that that's not a cop-out. That is just the reverent thing to do. Now, there was a guy behind you had a question, but ma'am, are you wanting to follow up on this particular point? Well, all right. Well, you come in now then.
No, no.
Same principles apply. Trees bearing fruit are symbols, which poets use, of something life-giving and something enriching and something that is valuable and so on and so forth. I don't know whether it was a literal tree or not, and I'm not bothered. I shall speak of it as the tree of knowledge and the tree of life the way the scripture does, knowing that those figures, symbols, as I still call them, communicate the right idea. The right idea, that is the idea that we are meant to pick up from the story. Here was something which looked very attractive and enriching, like fruit on trees, which does. I mean, we're all of us, I take it, human enough when we see fruit on trees, at least to think, don't I want to pick this? Perhaps you don't. But the first time, for instance, you see oranges growing on an orange tree, or peaches growing on a peach tree, or apples, good apples, growing on a good apple tree, plums, whatever, the thought goes through your mind, wouldn't it be nice to pick this and eat it? We're just made that way. It is human to like fruit. Again, there are exceptional people who don't, but the human race, generally speaking, does appreciate fruit. And so knows again and again the inclination to pick fruit off fruit trees. Am I making sense? And the rest is up to you. I mean, work your way through the symbolic elements of Genesis 2 and 3 at your leisure. I have said what I think is basic, namely that this is not myth, this is not fantasy, this is fact, but it's fact reported in a particular way. And we haven't got unlimited time, so we've got to wind down in a minute. The brother at the back, have you still got a question?
No, I don't.
Okay. Janice, did you want to raise something?
The question, is it important for us to understand the sense of theology of tree, good and evil, or is it just enough to recognize it as Adam and Eve's move out from under the dependence of God? Do we have more development than that?
Question, in studying the two trees in Genesis 3, is it important to think of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil as anything more than just something attractive which caught Eve's eye and made her want, well, under satanic prompting, made her want to grab it? I think the answer is yes, because it's specified that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil would make one wise in some sense. Remember, when Eve saw, this is Genesis 3:6, that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom. Now, the form in which Satan had offered her wisdom was an ungodly form. What Satan had offered her was, in effect, that she would be wise like God and so wouldn't need to depend on God for wisdom or perhaps for anything else. Satan had said, God knows that when you eat the fruit of the tree, you'll end up like God, knowing good and evil. And that was part of what it was that Eve grabbed, or tried to grab, in taking the fruit. And that ought to be part of our exposition of what was going on. The temptation was to become independent of God by becoming wise enough to maintain independence. You'll be like God, knowing good and evil. That is, knowing what's good for you, knowing what's bad for you, knowing what's worth doing, knowing how to live, and you won't need to ask God or learn from God about any of that. So that, I think, is certainly something that needs to be highlighted when we are expounding the passage. Okay?